The amount of divide and conquer tactics that they've tried, the amount of psychological pressure that they've, you know, used, none of it's worked. Like, we still, all of us with all of our differences, absolutely stand by protecting that land, protecting nature, the animals, the farms, the farmers, the soil, the water, the air.
Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge Mose. This is part two of our new mini-series, Dig Baby Dig, where we bring the pages of our print magazine to life by looking at the human cost of critical minerals mining. If you haven't already, I'd suggest going back and listening to part one with contributing editor Vanessa Baird. I spoke to her upon her return from South America, where she was reporting on the impacts of critical minerals mining in Peru and Chile.
When I started looking into this, I had to explain to people what critical minerals were. And now, thanks to Donald Trump, most people have heard of them because they know that he's after them in Ukraine, in Greenland, and in numerous other places too.
That episode is a great place to start if you want to understand what critical minerals actually are and why everyone is suddenly talking about them. Basically, these minerals are considered to have a strategically important role in the green transition, including in the development of renewable energy technologies. You can also check out our latest magazine to better understand how the rush for critical minerals seems to have accelerated in a world that feels increasingly insecure and unpredictable. Check it out in our show notes. But as so often happens when we tackle these big topics, some stories don't make it into the print magazine, simply because of space. That's why for today's episode, we're taking you to Serbia, where a transnational mining giant is trying to dig for lithium in spite of widespread and historic public protests. This is a cautionary tale, one that shows that beyond the people's rebellion lie deeper questions of imperialism, environmentalism, and so-called green tech. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Amy Hall, and I'm one of the co-editors at New Internationalist magazine. We're fiercely independent, and we're able to stay that way thanks to the incredible support of our readers and over 4,600 co-owners. By buying community shares in our cooperative, readers can fund in-depth, high-quality journalism which confronts injustice on a global scale. If this sounds exciting to you, visit our website, newint.org, to find out more.
My name is Bojana Novaković. I am from Serbia. I am part of the Mar Sabrine movement, which is a movement for the protection of land, water, food, and nature in the Jadar region against Rio Tinto's planned lithium project.
I met Bojana at Lab Left in Budapest last year, which was convened by the Hungarian left-wing political movement SIKRA to bring together progressive movements across Eastern Europe. New Internationalist was the media partner, so a few of us co-editors were there. Bojana is an actor. You may recognize her from films including Edge of Darkness with Mel Gibson and the Oscar-winning I, Tanya, in which she starred alongside Margot Robbie. She was born in Serbia and moved to Australia at the age of 7, hence the accent. When she's not shooting on location, she still spends much of her time in Serbia. But I didn't call Bojana to talk about her acting career.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to speak to you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. So I just wanted to start, I guess, by having you paint a little bit of a picture of specifically the land in the Jadar Valley in Serbia, where Rio Tinto plans to build its lithium mine. Can you kind of talk about, for those that haven't been there before, don't really know anything about it, what's your connection to the land and the people there, and what is most at stake if this project goes ahead?
Yeah, beautiful question. Thanks for starting the interview with that question, because everyone wants to get straight into the economy and like the climate crisis. So this is a really important question, because why do we care about the climate crisis unless it is to save spaces, green spaces and natural spaces that are exactly like the Jadar Valley? There is such a wealth of groundwater in that area that crops yield even when it's the drought in the middle of summer or fall in Serbia. You have forests. You have generational farming and very traditional farming practices being practiced in that area. So everything from raspberries, plums, tomatoes, vegetables, fruits, things like this, to wheat, corn. There's dairy farmers. It's a really beautiful place. And a small, lesser known fact about it is that actually there are a lot of sort of historical battles against Nazis or against the Austro-Hungarian Empire that was sort of fought there without army help. So this area has this history of we've helped ourselves, our ancestors helped us and, you know, kept this land for the generations ahead through war and literally bloodshed. And it very much feels like, particularly now, 5 years into the national campaign against this mine, that actually the campaign is no longer against the mine. It's just for the land. It's for the preservation of that land and nature.
Marsa Drine, which means get off the Drina, refers to the Drina River, which is one of several bodies of water at risk of serious contamination if the mine goes ahead. It started as a network of groups against the Anglo-Australian mining giant Rio Tinto, and has now expanded into a collection of citizens, independent experts, activists, and NGOs from Serbia and beyond.
Marsa Drine, we don't support any ideological doctrine, any religious doctrine. We're not affiliated with any corporations or organizations, and definitely not affiliated with any political platform or political party. Because our primary purpose is to preserve fertile soil and nature, biodiversity in the Yadar Valley, and protect it from the harms of mining.
The strength of feeling in Serbia after years of resource plunder, especially since the 2008 financial crisis, has also made the environment a unifying cause among people from all sides of the political spectrum. But the Rio Tinto mine remains one of the most controversial investments in Serbia's recent history. While the company has been digging for lithium in Serbia since 2005, to understand the widespread support for anti-lithium mining movements like Marsa Drine, and how they fit in with the ongoing anti-government protests in Serbia today, we have to go back to 2021.
Environment activists have protested outside government offices in Belgrade against plans to mine lithium in western Serbia. Mining giant Rio Tinto wants to extract the metal, which is a vital component of laptop and phone batteries.
For three consecutive weeks in November and December 2021, protesters blocked highways in many Serbian cities, demanding an end to Rio Tinto's plans for a $2.4 billion lithium mining project in the Jadar Valley. They said it would be detrimental to the local rural community and the environment. Rio Tinto told a different story.
These materials can be everything the world needs right now, and from now on.
According to forecasts by Deutsche Bank, most of the rise in demand for lithium is expected to come from the production of electric vehicles. Rio Tinto has claimed that the Jadar mine would produce enough lithium for 1 million car batteries each year, which it hopes to supply to German automobile companies. And though it doesn't have the biggest lithium reserves in the world, Rio Tinto has its sights firmly set on Serbia. I asked Bojana why that is.
My belief is that they thought it was an easy target because of the political instability, and that there is a dictator or an autocrat that runs that country who they can manipulate, as Europe has been doing for decades, you know, with the Serbian Progressive Party. I mean, this is terrible. This is a terrible name because they're definitely not progressive. They are, you know, they're neoliberals with a nationalistic flair.
Serbia is also a relatively low-income country with high unemployment and weak regulation. Its political policies are often criticized as merely playing catch-up with the EU. Last year, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Italy's Giorgia Meloni were among the European leaders that visited Serbia to create political pressure to support the European green transition. While Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić is typically seen as pro-Russian and blames the West for Serbia's political and economic woes, he's also known as somewhat of a strongman Balkan leader, who is propped up by the EU to maintain regional security and ensure European interests.
You ask why we've stayed silent for so long. How often have you come to tell us what's going on? What kind of genocide does this company and our state have in store for us?
The unprecedented wave of protests in 2021 made Serbia's officials gradually back down, and controversial bills on land confiscation were withdrawn. It seemed, at first, that the people had won. Here's Serbian Prime Minister Ana Brnabić at a press briefing in January 2022.
We have fulfilled all the requests of the environmental protests and put an end to Rio Tinto in the Republic of Serbia. Everything is finished. It's over.
But it turned out that the short-term street protests were not enough to put a definitive end to projects of such enormous interest for Rio Tinto's shareholders and EU governments. Vucic was re-elected president in April 2022, and a few days after the elections, he said that the decision to stop Rio Tinto had been a, quote, mistake.
What I do know from personal experience, from people who we work with very closely on the ground, is that there were absolutely people, farmers from the region, that voted for Vucic because they believed that the mine was cancelled. That their sort of take was, we've been asking him to cancel it. He cancelled it. Like, give the man a break. This is what we're asking the politicians to do. He did it. Of course, I'm going to vote for him. You know, I think that might have been a little bit shocking for some people at that time, but it definitely wasn't for us. What was more disturbing to me, I have to say, is Rio Tinto's reaction to the cancellation, because only a day after the cancellation, they were already meeting with the European Commission. And only 3 weeks after the cancellation, they were already making plans to re-strategize. You know, when we're looking at the situation, it's just as important to speak about the company as it is about Vucic, because, you know, it's hard to see who's puppeting who.
As soon became clear to the Serbian public, a legal mechanism passed by the ruling SNS party in 2015 granted the holder of exploration permits automatic entitlement to exploitation rights. This meant that Rio Tinto could technically sue the Serbian government if it refused to play ball. Bojana believes Vucic agreed to stop the mine ahead of the 2022 elections in order to placate the public and secure his re-election.
We've always known that Vucic did it in order to win the election or to not affect that election that was coming up. He's a lot like Trump. In fact, I would say Trump is a lot like him and is learning a lot from him. And all I'm seeing Trump do is literally from the Vucic playbook.
For now, the project is halted, which Bojana sees as a major victory.
I believe that that's a huge success. Like, People Power delayed the project by 2 years.
But Vucic said last year that he was ready to endorse it once again. And this time, the public is pushing back even harder. The ongoing student-led anti-government protests in Serbia emerged after a deadly disaster at a train station on November 1st in the city of Novi Sad. It killed 14 people and injured 2. Many blamed the deaths on corruption and a lack of oversight of the Chinese construction project. Here's Bojana on Serbian television talking about the link between Marsa Drine and the Novi Sad protesters.
The canopy in Novi Sad collapsed and killed 14 people because those responsible didn't adhere to regulation. They built it illegally. We won't let that happen with a mine.
The protests have seen widespread support from people across Serbia, including lawyers, teachers, farmers, small business owners, and, crucially, those in the anti-lithium mining group, like Marsa Drine. Speaking to Bojana, it's clear that when it comes to building popular movements, there are a lot of lessons in resistance to be learned from Serbia.
Definitely in the broader context of Serbia and rural communities, you know, just like any rural spaces that you're going to see, you're going to have a real mix of people. And in the rural communities, there's a real mix between very left and very right. But the biggest surprise I think I've experienced is that people who define themselves as right wing, I'm like, you are so left, you don't even know. Like, you think that you're a nationalist, but you're a patriot. Or, you know, you think that because you're for workers' rights, you belong to a right faction, but actually that's a very leftist thing. Like, you're a communist, but you think that you're a Chetnik. You know, like, it's just been very humorous and fun and funny and sort of enjoyable to laugh about it with people. Having said all of that, I do think that there is an absolute danger in Europe, and Serbia is part of Europe, even though it's not part of the European Union, that the movement for food sovereignty and land rights can absolutely be usurped by nationalists. I do think that we have also, all of us, learned how to speak to each other. I mean, this has led us to be able to speak to people, listen to people, hold space, and also then that leads to other people holding space for us. I find the romanticization of landowners or people who live on land that's being protected is part of the problem, because it kind of dehumanizes people. People are who they are. We're flawed, right? Don't think that we don't argue and bicker and, you know, have fights and arguments. We do. But the point is that we're still a successful movement as a whole. And I think that this is another weapon of ours that the company and the government can't figure out. Like the amount of divide and conquer tactics that they've tried, and it's not hard to divide and conquer Serbians. Believe me, we fight all the time. The amount of divide and conquer tactics that they've tried, the amount of psychological pressure that they've, you know, used, none of it's worked. Like we still, all of us with all of our differences, absolutely stand by protecting that land, protecting nature, the animals, the farms, the farmers, the soil, the water, the air.
But that doesn't mean that protesting in Serbia doesn't come without huge risks. Scores of activists and journalists have been arrested for organizing the latest protests, including members of Mars Adrine.
I think primarily, you know, there's the psychological impact, which I think can never be underestimated. And, you know, I can only imagine what it's like for people that live on the land itself. But even more importantly is sort of this national campaign to tarnish the reputations of land protectors in Serbia through criminalization, through mass arrests that led to absolutely nothing. So there was a slew of mass arrests over about a week of about 20 to 30 activists, including a pregnant woman, brought into police stations on bogus charges of constitutional, like breaching the order of the constitution. And of course, all of these people were let go, but it was this attempt to scare people from actually speaking out against the project and organizing ongoing protests. So there's this constant sort of criminalization of land protection. So there's been a lot of manipulation and, yeah, particularly this stuff with criminalization that has been very scary and taken its toll. And it's also taken its toll on people that weren't in prison. You know, it's taken its toll on the whole community in a way. It is what they do. I mean, colonizers be colonizing. I don't know what else to tell you.
In light of all the risks facing protesters within the movement, I wanted to ask Bojana more about the group's use of direct action.
So when you realize that the law isn't working the way that it's designed or certain laws are being broken, then of course people are going to take the law into their own hands. Those people are on the streets because their right to a clean environment and a healthy living environment is being violated. That's a constitutional right. And so they gather and create havoc because they're protecting that constitutional right. That's what civil disobedience is. So obviously, I'm not going to give like a masterclass in civil disobedience. It can take many different forms. And, you know, I think it's very dependent on who you are, where you are, who your group is, who your target audience is, you know, what your requests are. But the one thing that we always do is we always have a legal request behind any action that we invite the public to partake in. And we don't invite the public to partake in anything that we won't ourselves take part in. So that's a really important thing. And I feel like there's been a lot of different groups who have invited and organized protests, you know, along the way. And I feel like every single one of those groups has always had that kind of tenet as like a basis for civil disobedience. The right to protest is a human right too. So, you know, we have a right to be disobedient when the great right of, you know, right to clean living environment is being violated.
So just as a final question, and it's something that was asked to some campaigners in Chile, where we also did a piece for our magazine about the lithium mining happening in Chile. What do you say to someone who, you know, may have been listening to you speak on this podcast or may have been observing from afar the developments in Serbia with regards to the mine? What do you say to those who argue that, you know, the planet can't wait, we're in a climate emergency, lithium is a key part of the essential transition, even if it means some places like the Jadar Valley are, you know, what this concept of zones of sacrifice. And, you know, unfortunately, some people, some land are just going to have to be collateral in that. What's your response to someone who might make that argument?
I would say the first two points you said are right on, whoever you are, like, great. You're right on with those points. Like, yes, there is a crisis going on. I would say that lithium is a crucial part of that solution is completely scientifically unsound argument on so many fronts. So we can unpack that in a second. But I think primarily, you know, this thing that you were sort of talking about, I think primarily in terms of sacrifice zones, I would say that I am open to discussing sacrifice zones, right? You can come for like my village, but only after you've discussed sacrificing the entities that have really caused the climate crisis. So let's discuss sacrificing the military-industrial complex, sacrificing plastic production, sacrificing the wealth gap, sacrificing wealth itself. You know, let's talk about sacrificing all of those entities, things, you know, before we talk about sacrificing an ecosystem. And I think what's happened with the green transition is it has, you know, that capitalism has paid a really good consultant and hired an amazing marketing manager. And that marketing manager has gone, what you're going to do is you're going to provide yourself, capitalism, as the solution to this thing that you've created called the climate crisis by rebranding. You know, all of a sudden you're green. And all of these things that were in place that put us in this into this problem, which are overproduction, overconsumption, you know, mining, military production, all of these things are going to be business as usual, but you're just going to put a green stamp on them. And here we go. You know, I would also say that when you talk about lithium, and now I'm going back to lithium, when you said lithium is part of the solution, you know, every time that someone says lithium is needed for electric cars, they forget that so is nickel, so is copper, so is cobalt, so is like, so is iron, so is plastic. And they forget that each of these minerals or raw materials needs a mine of its own. And they forget that it's not just a lithium mine in this area, but if you're talking about all of the raw materials, it's like 8, 9, 10 mines, you know, maybe even 12. And so there's been this really interesting, I think, attack from Europe about reliance on China, which has also become part of the green propaganda, which is we rely so much on China for all our raw materials for our, you know, for this and that. And there's no discussion of, well, if we don't want to rely on China, maybe we start to restructure the consumption that we partake in, right? Because that's one way to actually really not rely on pretty much anyone. Like, how about we consume less, we produce less? Wow, like watch the market, like watch people freak out and watch us get more wealthy because we're producing good food, or, you know, we've got clean water sources, and watch our lives improve, quality of health, you know, all this stuff improve. I feel like that would be like my response to those people. And I think sometimes those questions are very much questions that have been posed by the marketing manager of capitalism. You know, you need lithium for the green transition. That's an amazing marketing tool. You know, it's like saying you need Nike to win this race.
Yeah. And it conveniently allows these companies to say, you know, this is the single most important material. We're the ones to dig it up and share it with the world.
I just want to actually add something onto this, which is a little bit of market distortion. You know, there's this kind of, there's like, particularly with Rio Tinto. Now I'm really talking about Rio Tinto here because, and particularly with lithium, right? So most of the world's lithium is processed in China. Rio Tinto has never processed lithium. So when you say, oh, we'd dig it out of the ground, like, I don't think people understand what the process of actually digging any ore out of the ground is. You know, like there's gunpowder. You're basically bombing the fuck out of the ground, you know, first. And then there's all these chemical processes that then leach chemicals into the environment that leads to you getting this little powder. And then there's the battery production. And then there's the assembling of the car. Like these are all huge processes. And people just, I think when people say lithium, they just think lithium car, it's here, right? And particularly with Rio Tinto, and the reason why I want to talk about the market distortion is like Rio Tinto's biggest shareholder is a Chinese company called Chinalco, and they own 15% of the company's shares, right? And with the Critical Raw Materials Act, which is sort of this sort of new law in Europe that's allowing, it's basically a green light for more mining. I mean, really, that's what it's legalized more mining, which is the legalization of more land occupation and resource theft. Let's put it into those terms too. That law has absolutely no stipulations or guarantees that once a project is approved or even granted strategic status under the Critical Raw Materials Act, that the owner of that project can't sell it to a foreign bidder, which is China, or can't sell the ore somewhere else. I mean, they made a law that doesn't even safeguard the reason behind what they say the law is. And that to me is just, it just shows once again, like this is not about, there's such a corporate takeover of government. even laws are no longer about protecting, you know, human rights, rights of nature and our right to a clean living environment. They are absolutely about protecting businesses and you know, profit margins.
That was Bojana Novaković, an actor and activist with the Mars Sedrine movement in Serbia. At the time of releasing this episode, massive student-led anti-government protests are still ongoing in Serbia. In March, the European Commission approved the first 47 strategic projects for boosting critical materials supplies in EU territory, and said proposals for third countries will follow. Vučić is sure to do everything in his power to get the Rio Tinto lithium project listed among them. Meanwhile, activists with Mars Sedrine have said they would legally challenge the strategic status designation for disputed mining projects and insist they will not back down until the mining project is abandoned for good. Thanks for tuning in to this new mini-series, Dig Baby Dig. For more on what you've heard today, check out the links in our show notes. In the next episode, we're taking you to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where corruption, pollution, and child labor have long blighted the DRC's cobalt industry.
The DRC as country has been playing a critical role on supply chain of cobalt. We supply the chain with about 70% of the global demand of cobalt. But we are struggling to actually capture benefit from cobalt exploitation.
I spoke to experts from Global Witness and from a Congolese advocacy group about how to turn the country's critical mineral wealth into a blessing rather than a burden.
We need to secure energy and electricity for these Africans working on the continent. It's not enough for this revolution to actually pass us by.
Be sure to subscribe to The World Unspun wherever you get your podcasts to be the first to know when this episode drops. That's it for now. If you were inspired by what you heard today and want to read more of our reporting on critical minerals, subscribe to New Internationalist to read our latest issue in full. Check out our show notes where you'll find a link to subscribe. And don't forget to use the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and or digital subscription. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey, and Vanessa Baird is the contributing editor of our latest issue. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuse. Audio editing is by Nasi Kamza. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.